a street of villains, take him for a ride. You can have the devil as a guide. Crippled by the boundaries, programmed into guilt, till your nervous system starts to tilt. In a room of mirrors, you can see for miles, but everything that's there is in disguise. Every word you've uttered and every thought you've had is all inside your files, the good and the bad. But in the rising sun, you can feel your life begin. Universe at play inside your DNA.
So when you ask me about like the serious symbolism, you know, it's like I can point to you like the fact that the winter gardens, the palm lined winter gardens, palms meaning phoenix, meaning rebirth, aligns with the monolith hotel, the Millennium Hotel, based on the monolith from 2001. You know, these are established facts. This is not speculation.
I grew up in New York City. I had never been down to that. The World Financial Center? It's a World Trade Center.
World Financial Center, which, right, you know, the rooftops of which encode Stairway to Sirius.
Right. So I had never been, and I read your blog, and I was like, well, this is my hometown. I'm going to go check it out, right? If I told you this, I apologize. But, you know, Jay Kotz's sort of, you know, the whole thing with the monolith and the 9/11 Stargate and all that sort of stuff. And he always draws everything back to the number 42, right? And at some point it became like, I was sort of like, all right, whatever, he's connecting everything to 42. But I went down to that Winter Garden space and they have that stairway that leads up to it's a palm-lined stairway that leads up to this glass that overlooks the World Trade Center site, right? And at the top there's this big starburst pattern on the top landing, and just for shits and giggles,
you counted
I walked around a circle and counted them, 42 rays. Yeah, and I was like, I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're saying. You know, I grew up on the 42nd parallel, so I know exactly right. What you're saying. So anyway, boy, we went really far afield here.
Yeah, sorry.
No, so the Sirius symbolism. I've been following a different kind of symbolism in this year's campaign logos. It'll be, you know, once the party tickets are set, it'll be interesting to see if the Sirius symbolism does reemerge. I haven't noticed.
The double swirl is almost like the Aquarius symbol, right?
Well, what I'm seeing is like this strange, like all I can say is that it looks like snakes, and I'm seeing it repeated through a number of different primary campaign logos, that it seems that there's a little too much of it to be coincidental. But you know, one of the things I saw in Ted Cruz's logo is like this kind of Eye of Sauron design that was really, really troubling. You know, people can look that up on the blog. But that sort of fits into this whole, you know, that the symbolism that we're seeing is not uplifting. It's not, there's something, you know, like if it is, in fact, you know, I left it open. I was not making a definitive statement as to what the symbolism that we're seeing in these logos is. But if it is, you know, snake symbolism, serpent symbolism, I mean, can there be, you know, a greater contrast from like stellar symbolism to serpent symbolism? I mean, it's like, you know, above and below. And it almost feels like, you know, we're stuck, you know, in first gear. We're below. We're in this very, like, we're in the mire, you know, we're almost like trapped underground. It almost feels like.
Well, that makes me think two things. I mean, so the Donald Trump is always talking about Mexico, right? Their, if I'm not mistaken, their flag features an eagle and a snake fighting.
Well, he's also, you know, the other thing I read is that he's been citing these lyrics in his campaign speeches that are about snakes. That's about a snake. It's this old Al Wilson song. And it seems like some sort of signaling. You know, whenever you don't understand it, when some sort of symbolism shows up in politics, you know, rest assured that it is some kind of signaling.
Even
If
when
it,
Ben Carson quoted the Pokemon lyrics.
yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it has some sort of, you know, that almost seems like mind control. You know, it reminds me of like the DC sniper. What was that line about the ducks or something? Or, no, but yeah, I just read this last night, and I went and read the lyrics to the song he's quoting, and it's about this woman who invites the snake into her house, and I'm thinking, why is he reciting these lyrics? This is extremely strange, but this does tend to confirm my suspicion that the symbolism that we are seeing in these campaign logos is some sort of serpent motif. But again, it's like I don't have enough,
Oh, the other thing I
you
was
know,
going
I don't have
to.
enough evidence to make a definitive conclusion on
Yeah,
that
no
yet.
definitive statement here. I just. Well, so what I was thinking was, you know, if everyone's comparing him to the Nazis, you have their symbol being the eagle. You have, like I said, the flag of Mexico with the eagle fighting the serpent. But then you also have the 2012 Quetzalcoatl is what? Is the winged serpent, right? So it's actually the marriage of the two.
Yeah, I know. It's
I'm just throwing. Yeah, who.
no, you're not. No, I'm, believe me, that these are you know, on when I nothing in politics is accidental. And you know, the thing that I had said about the Oscar, you know, there was the whole thing with Oscar so white, you know, that hashtag on Twitter. And so there was this whole controversy about the Oscars, but when you actually watch the Oscars, it was just drenched in this solar symbolism. So I don't know if people even recognized it. It's like you get caught up in this political controversy, but at the same time, you know, you're primed with the political controversy. It was like the most explicit solar symbolism that, you know, this is nothing new to the Oscars, believe me, but this year it was particularly
Do
explicit.
you put any weight into there was these different sort of ideas going around that, right? We have a yellow sun, which of course where Superman gets his power, but that our sun was, and that it wasn't just an atmospheric condition, but that our sun was turning more white into turning more of a white star.
You know, I do have to wonder that, because when I hear this whole talk about the sun being gold and all this kind of stuff, it's like when I look at the sun, I don't see it being, you know, it looks gold at sunset, I guess, but yeah, I think that's very
I'm
interesting.
just saying, Oscar, if it's the solar so white, I don't know. Just
I don't know if that's, I don't know, that's seems a little bit of a stretch, but like to me, it's like, you know, what I call Knowles's law is that whenever there's an eruption about symbolism in the media, it's almost always a cover for an entirely different symbolic message, you know, that's being put across.
Right. So you're saying not so much that that in itself is part of the overall message, but that it's just a distraction from what's really going on.
Well, you know, there were two things that really struck me about the Oscars. First of all, was the solar symbolism, but also it was just like this ostentatious display of wealth and
Oh my
privilege.
God, was Chris Rock was the host, right?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was telling my family
Christ
last night
Rock,
that,
Peter, sorry.
yeah, well, Chris Rock said something interesting. He said if America knew how celebrities actually lived, there would be a revolution. You know, he said that celebrities have everything given to them, you know, expensive watches, vacations, cars. I mean, things that Americans work very hard for, they get for free. And they just live these lives of just such intense privilege. And, you know, that's something that I was just really struck by. With the Oscars, with this whole, you know, this whole adoration of gold. You know, we all dream in gold, and all the gold symbolism and stuff. And it's just, you know, what an inappropriate time to be flaunting this stuff in America's face. You know, I know we're supposed to be in economic recovery, quote unquote, but, you know, I don't know how many people actually feel that. You know, I don't know how many people feel that, you know, they are actually economically better off than they were before the
Not a single person I know.
No, not a single person I know. And you know, all these jobs that are replacing the jobs that are lost are all jobs that are paying a fraction of, you know, the jobs that were lost. So, again, you know, it's interesting because these frayed nerves that seem so prevalent in our society today, you know, again, you know, tying back to that whole thing with the X-Files, that it all seemed to be, you know, about frayed nerves and things like that. But I think that you know, on a basic, like, say, you know, just production level, I had real problems with Dave Duchovny and Gillian Anderson's performances. Like, it didn't feel like Mulder and Scully to me. It seemed like they were playing totally different characters. Duchovny seemed like he was playing his Californication character, and she seemed like she was playing her character from The Fall with an American accent. So I wonder if some of these crazy ideas that they were trying to communicate, you know, that they were just jam packing into these episodes, probably would have carried over better. You know, maybe if the not only if the writing had been a little, you know, more carefully attended to, but if the, you know, if the acting, I don't know. Did you notice that at all? That they it just didn't
Oh,
seem.
absolutely. See, I'll be honest. I don't. The X-Files is the first TV show I've watched in a long time with people. Like I think a part of it has to do like so I actually haven't owned a television in my home in years, but there was
What do you watch?
I watch a lot of anime at this point. I watch movies. If I'm gonna watch something with people, it's gonna be a movie.
See, I have a serious problem, and I should probably, you know, reveal this problem to the world, is that I've lost my you know, my ability to suspend my disbelief. And it's a major problem. You know, everybody talks about all these great TV shows, and I'll watch them, and I just very quickly lose interest because it's I just see people pretending to be people that they're not.
Precisely. I can't. I
And
can't. I don't know if it's bad acting. I don't know if it's HDTV again, which I don't have HDTV, so I don't think that's what it is. It just feels like the fake. It's so fake. There's no separation. There's no. Again, is that me? Is that them? I don't know, but it's distasteful to watch. Like, I can't, it just gives me a really bad taste in my mouth to look at any of it.
Yeah, I it's a very uncomfortable thing for me because I, you know, I want to be entertained. You
Sure,
know,
yeah.
I want to watch this stuff, but I just I can't believe it anymore. And it's a major problem for me because one of the problems is that, you know, one of the things I talked about on the blog is that I've a number of years ago I had some screenplays that I was writing and they were getting some attention out in California and stuff. Actually, one of them got too much attention because it was actually made into a movie, you know, without me being credited or paid or, you know, that's a very upsetting episode in my life. People, you know,
Oh, I
maybe
yeah.
in the show, maybe in the show notes, I'll refer to people to that post in the blog. But what I had done is that I'd sort of done the Quentin Tarantino method, where you just rent like a shit ton of movies and watch them and analyze them and see how they're made. And I came to the kind of conclusion that movies are all kind of the same, that they all sort of follow the same beats, they all sort of follow the same rhythms. You know, that they're incredibly formulaic, at least you know, certainly commercial Hollywood movies are. You know, they all sort of follow what's, you know, the Sid Fields method. And I just became very disenchanted with that. And when I see, it's kind of like, you know, you bake donuts all day and then you can't stand to even look at donuts when you get home. When I understood the construction of these narratives, it lost a lot of the mystique for me. And then when I began doing the work on the blog and really began parsing out the symbolism, you know, almost frame by frame in many regards, and really deconstructing things for the semiotic value, you know, that again, you know, added to this kind of disenchantment. But I think, you know, just the final blow was just seeing one too many of these committee written Hollywood blockbusters that are just basically excuses for massive displays of CGI budgets that have no compelling narratives, no believable characters. And I, you know, I just saw one too many of these movies and it just kind of soured me for the whole experience. Like I'll see some, you know, some indie movies and
I watch a
sort
lot
of,
of like some
you
movies. I
know,
go
like,
like back. I go back in time. Like if I watch an older movie, you know, like watching a
yes, before
Quarterman.
the formula took, yeah, before the formulas kicked in. Yeah,
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I like I'll go back to the 70s before there were this dogmatic adherence to these storytelling structures. You know, and I find it much more satisfying, particularly, you know, movies that are more experimental, say like a Robert Altman film, you know, where he's messing with, you know, with narrative and things like that. And, you know, I still love, you know, a filmmaker like David Lynch, but he's not really making films
Well, are you,
anymore,
so I
so.
started to ask you before, are you excited about the return of Twin Peaks, or do you have the same sort of apprehension that you had from X-Files?
Well, let's face the facts. The second season of Twin Peaks was
Sure,
terrible.
sure was, yeah.
It was terrible. It had some very interesting, again, it was one of these things where there's some very interesting semiotic and subtextual
Yeah, you have to sit through 15 minutes of
strands.
musical garbage to get to like something interesting.
And it just became a parody of itself.
Totally.
And I was like, well, wait a minute. They had a mini season. You know, how did this happen so quickly? How did this fall apart so quickly? How did this descend into parody so quickly? And I think people are remembering how great, you know, that first week was, you know, that mini series was, and forgetting how God numbingly awful the second season was. And I think the Fire Walk With Me is more controversial. I you know, there's a wide range of opinion on that movie. I personally thought, you know, I see its faults, but you know, I think that it's, you know, very
Oh
rich.
yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah, you know, I can certainly recognize why a lot of people don't, but you know, I think it's got some very tasty strands of you know, meaning and symbolism and dream reality beneath all the kind of madness in it. But so it's kind of, I don't know. I really I loved Inland Empire. I thought Inland Empire was brilliant. But at the same time, Inland Empire is basically the same movie as Mulholland Drive. I mean, they're essentially the same movie. They're just variations on a theme. So I don't know. It really remains to be seen. You know, with the X-Files, you know, the Twin Peaks was before the internet. It was from a different time and place. But then again, I just don't know if they can return to that. I don't know if they can go back and remember where their heads were at and where the culture was at, you know, and recapture that, you know, that magic, you know. I can't see it happening. So I'm not necessarily optimistic about it.
Can I ask you
And
if you have this a similar so again I'm not having not watched I really I just mean it I can't tell you the last TV show I watched. What stood out to me about this X-Files was how much a cell phone has gotten in the way of script writing because they had to keep forcing where like Scully's trying to call Mulder and she can't get him on the phone or he like calls her, she says, "I'm sorry, I can't talk right now." He's like, "No, we have to talk right now, except I'm gonna hang up on you in the middle of a sentence because I don't feel like answering the phone that I just made you answer." Because if you could just talk on a phone, you don't have to get the characters in the same location. It's this
Well,
workaround that.
you know, that was very much a part of the original
But I
series.
guess
And I'll tell you.
what I'm sorry, I let you go. I just want to say, like,
No, you finish your
my thought
thought.
is just simple. Like, I wonder as you bring. Try and bring these, you know, the Twin Peaks, the mystique of the mountain living, and the sort of the almost fan quasi fantasy removed, you know, setting. Just dropping everyone's got a smartphone in their pocket, change
Yeah,
that.
exactly. I can't see it happening. The only way I can see it happening is if they take it out of time and put it in a different era. You know what I mean? Like take the story out of 2016 and bring it, you know,
A
create
timeless world, yeah.
yeah, like a no time.
Precisely, yeah.
You know, and I think if anybody can pull that off, I think it's David Lynch.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know what I mean? But again, I can't see that. I can't see this being a passion project for him. You know what I'm saying? And that's my problem with it. And you know, like I said, with the X-Files, I mean, there was, you know, there were some very vital components that were missing that were very much part of the original series you know were not in evidence. And I don't know if I really felt like, you know, I felt like they were trying to do a lot, you know, on the symbolic level, and that's sort of where their heads are at. And again, that's what I was feeding off of, and there was a lot to feed off. I mean, there was a lot of food there, but I don't know if that's necessarily enough. And that's another thing that I'm worried about with Twin Peaks is that, you know, David Lynch does have a tendency to outthink himself. You know, he can be a little too clever for his own good. And, you know, as much as I love his films, they've never been mass audience pleasers, you know, so I don't know. We'll see what happens. But I think that people are going to be disappointed. I don't see how they cannot be.
Right.
Because I think what people are experiencing is their nostalgia. You know, with all these things, you know, it's like when a band gets back together. There are very few bands that recapture the magic. And it's usually the bands that didn't define their era. You know, it's sort of the bands that bubbled under the surface that can kind of come back and be vital again because they weren't defined by their time and therefore didn't become prisoners of their time. I know that's one of the things I've noticed. When bands that were defined an era and defined a generation and all those kind of cliches, when they return, the letdown is always inevitable because you can't go back. You know, you can't be 17 again. You can't see the world as you did when you were 17 again. They can play the old songs, but you know, you know the old songs already. So it's a very difficult thing to recapture. But believe me, you're going to be seeing a lot more of it because, you know, whatever we think of the X-Files, you know, and you know, I guess my final verdict on it would be problematic or maybe ambivalent is too strong a word. Maybe ambiguous would be better. I think ambiguous would probably be a verdict. It brought in the viewers and it raked in a lot of advertising dollars. So that's a signal to networks that there's a lot of money to be made in bringing back old franchises whenever possible. So I think you're going to be seeing a lot of it.
And we already have been reboot after reboot, and it's
Well,
gone.
look what happened with Arrested Development. I mean, everybody's like, oh, bring back Arrested Development, bring back Arrested Development. They brought it back and everybody's like, ugh. You know, everybody's disappointed. Maybe the show, you know, wasn't exactly what they remembered it to be. You know, maybe their opinions and impressions of the show was born out of a sense of ownership, that it was sort of this sleeper, quirky, off the beaten track show that wasn't a mainstream hit, that people sort of felt like they had a sense of ownership to. And then when it comes back and it gets a lot of attention, you know, you can't replicate that. You know, this is what I'm saying, that there is an alchemy to these kind of things. When something hits, when something resonates, as pretentious as it sounds, and it sounds like so horribly pretentious and empty, and it's the kind of crap that you hear, like, you know, people with degrees who really have nothing interesting to say, you know, but there really is an alchemy to this. There's an alchemical process to this, you know. Kubrick never made a 2001 sequel because he knew he never could. He knew he could never recapture, you know, the excitement he felt, you know, as a younger man diving into, you know, the space program and science fiction and everything, because he, you know, he'd become a jaded older man, you know, who had a very dim view of the world. He could never recap. He could never return to
Kubrick
that
strikes me
person.
like a Bowie, where the only way they could stay interested was to keep changing genres. So it was like Kubrick like made like a science fiction movie, a horror movie, it was like, okay, well, give me another genre so I can get reinvigorated, you know?
Well, the interesting thing with Bowie is that Bowie ended, you know, Bowie ended up going back to being Bowie. He ended up doing, you know, sort of a classic Bowie sound again. I guess the first attempt of it was with Hours, but it didn't really take hold until Heathen. And I didn't, you know, I thought this was a creative decision, but what this really was a financial imperative, because what had happened, and I read about this recently, is that at the time he started making these more conventional Bowie kind of doing Bowie records, is that record companies were taking write backs on artist advances if these records didn't do well. And there were a number of you know, very prominent big name artists who were having to pay back their advances to record companies if their records didn't make a profit. So, you know, when Bowie started doing more, when he stopped doing like jungle records or techno records and started doing, you know, acoustic ballads and things like that, it was because he had to, you know, that he was financially, you know, forced to, that if he didn't turn a profit, that the record companies had allowed themselves the luxury of asking for their money back. So, you know, I think that's a very interesting thing, that sort of put paid to Bowie's career as a chameleon. And I'm sure if Kubrick had continued as a filmmaker, the exact same thing would have happened to him, that he would have undergone that exact same process, because I'm sure that he could not survive. I mean, there's no question. I mean, Kubrick would, if he were alive today, would be making independent films. He would not be allowed to continue in the Hollywood studio system as it exists today. And we know this because, you know, none of the other filmmakers of his kind are as well, you know, are as well, you know.
Precisely.
You
Right,
know,
the era of experimentation is out because you need the surefire hit. That's why they've reduced everything to formula. And it's like, well, if you're going to take a chance, you're taking the chance with your money, not ours.
yes, and that is why, you know, and it's interesting. This is beginning to backfire. I just posted a thing in the Secret Sun Facebook group that old music is now beginning to outsell new music. So I think that what I recognize in these films, you know, the creation by committee, the relentless adherence to a formula, people, you know, it's like you can fool some of the people some of the time and so on. I think in certainly in music, people are beginning to, you know, resist that, and people, you know, and, you know, particularly younger people, which I find really interesting. Younger people are listening to, you know, the Rolling Stones, you know, or people like David Bowie and or Johnny Cash or things like that. You know, they're seeking authenticity because they're rejecting the pre-fabricated pabulum that the record companies are offering them. And you know, I mean, that's encouraging. You know, I think that I hope that that branches out into other media. But the problem is with film is that film is incredibly expensive. The days of being able to make a movie for $500,000, maybe you could pull it off with digital video and things like that, and asking all your friends to work for free, but you're not necessarily going to get anybody to show the film. You're certainly not going to get it into the theaters anymore. That door has been shut. So I think that, and the problem is too, is that it's just so much competition. You go to Redbox and you see movies with major stars that never get released in the theaters, competing with like knockoff junk, like
Yeah.
phony Transformers movies.
Right.
You know what I'm
It's like I
saying?
right, you I don't I pass those red boxes and I'm like, I've never even heard of this. When
Yeah, and it's starring like Angelina Jolie or
Right.
something, It's like, what the hell is going on? It's the economics of filmmaking. I mean, there are a lot of people who are predicting doom for the, that basically films like Star Wars and the superhero movies are basically keeping the entire system solvent. And without that, the entire system would collapse. Most movies don't make money. Most movies fail. So, but I think there's a reason for that, because most movies don't speak to people anymore. They don't speak to people on those deeper levels. And I think the problem is that, younger people have not only been programmed, but have allowed themselves to, be programmed. I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of, great young filmmakers out there who want to make quirky individual statements that are filled with semiotic and symbolic richness. But, for the most part, they can't get past the gatekeepers. I mean, there are good examples. I mean, like the movie Beyond the Black Rainbow is a great example of that. Did you see that movie?
I did not know.
Oh, definitely see that movie. I mean, that's a perfect example of, I mean, that's the kind of movie that if David Lynch were young, he'd be making. But then there's the example. I mean, I'm really discouraged by what happened to Richard Kelly. I thought The Box was a great movie. And not only was it rejected by, the system, but it also got a terrible score from like CinemaScore, which means the viewers didn't like it. And it depresses the hell out of me, because it's like, that is such a rich and strange and layered and textured movie, so filled with sub-meaning and symbol and high strangeness. The fact that that could not find an audience at all, it seems, that like really depresses me. When a movie like that fails, even to become a cult hit, that's a very depressing sign to me, because that shows that there's not only a supply side problem, but there's a demand side problem. And you saw that, right? You
Oh
saw The Box, right?
I see not did I see that, but I see the problem that you're talking about, right, where it's like people don't even know what to ask for. I got excited like say when I'm sure you've seen Room 237.
Oh, yeah.
So I got so excited that that got he got some distribution through IFC, right? And that I've met a lot of people in the quote unquote, normal world who say they've seen that. And like, I'm always like, I would get excited. Oh, wow. What'd you think of that? Right? This is maybe the first time, maybe we could have a conversation about something interesting, I'm thinking. And they're like, it was all right. And
Yeah,
I'm like,
that.
really? So maybe it was just made, maybe it was made for fans. I don't know. But that movie gave me a lot of hope.
Well, that I think that movie was. I mean, that's a cineast film. You know what I mean? That's a movie nerd film. I mean, it isn't just a conspiracy nerd film. It's a that is a.
I don't get why the word conspiracy kind of always got thrown at that movie. I don't.
I think it's because of
Right. The
the
industry doesn't
Apollo
have. Yeah, the
material.
industry doesn't have another fucking word for it. But John Fell Ryan, the guy, he's one of the interviewees. Like when he's talking about synchronicities and talking about. Like Rodney Asher, the filmmaker, actually plays with this by showing, they're talking about the man, about Jack and Danny Torrance, and then John Paul Ryan's on the phone. He's like, "Oh, hold on!" You hear his kid in the background, and by weaving all these into the film, into the documentary, letting the synchronicities bleed through, things like that. Is what really inspired me about it. The like, hey, let's look into the meaning behind Kubrick. That's still cool. I love Kubrick movies. I love talking about that kind of stuff. But it was more the bleed through of letting the synchronicity be quietly spotlit.
Well, here's the good thing is that it's there,
Yeah.
and it exists. I mean, things have a tendency to find an audience. And maybe it's just it's a question of people just need to become disenchanted. And I've seen that happen. I've seen people who I thought would never get off the candy diet, get sick of it and look for more nutritious mind food. So it does happen. And if the material exists, then there's hope. I mean, I still hold hope for the box. I still hold hope that people who get into Donnie Darko are going to want to check out, what else this guy has done, and will not be expecting another Don. I think that's maybe what happened with that movie,
Right.
is that people were expecting another Donnie Darko, and that's not what they got. So, but we'll be mature enough to think, well, I'm not going to expect him to remake the same movie again, and we'll appreciate that movie for what it's worth. Because I'll tell you, if I was Richard Kelly, I would be like so monumentally depressed. That movie just sunk, because that movie is a gold mine. I just that movie blew my mind. Not only did it blow my mind, but it was actually filmed in like n w this is really odd. It was like filmed in like my old stomping grounds. It was filmed in like neighborhoods that I used to run around in up in Massachusetts. Which is like a really weird place. Like we, some of the neighborhoods that he filmed that movie in are like not places that people film movies in. So I was like, that was like a real major sink for me. I was like, wait, I know that neighborhood. What the hell is that doing in this movie?
That's
So,
awesome.
yeah, that was. It was really. I that had a.
Okay, we're recording. Yeah, sorry we lost the we got dropped there. I think we were talking about
Richard Kelly in the
the original.
Box.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, which is a great movie, and I think everyone who listens to this should go out and find it and watch it and love it. And if you don't love it the first time, watch it again. Keep watching it until you do love it.
And same, if you listen to this episode and you didn't love it, listen to it again.
Exactly.
I could ask you a million more questions. It's always a pleasure talking to you, but thank you, man. This has just been a real treat. So,
All right, appreciate it. It was a good time.
is there anything you want to sort of add here at the end, or anything you want to plug? I'm going to link to all that. We've addressed a number of these different articles from your blog. I'm going to try and link
Yeah.
to a bunch of them and.
Yeah. Well, I post a lot of the things about the X-Files on the sister blog, The Solar Satellite, which is secretsonjr.blogspot.com. And that's sort of set up. You'll see the interface and be able to access those articles. As far as the blog is concerned, it's just fascinating to me that this year seems to be, almost like a culmination of themes that I've been, playing with for a number of years that have all sort of begun to bear fruit. I'm not exactly sure, how to term that, but they seem to have been definitely raised in the public consciousness. For years I was talking about Jack Kirby, and I don't even think that people understood what, what exactly I was talking to, but he's basically the guy who created all the Marvel Universe characters that are, so dominant in the movies today. And he's finally beginning to get his recognition, which is exciting. There was actually a major exhibition of his work out in California, and it featured a lot of his more esoteric leaning material, which I was very gratified to see, because he was extremely esoterically oriented, which just goes to show you the power of the esoteric imagination and how it filters up, and that, I would argue that it, is the source of creativity that, is maybe not acknowledged widely, but if you trace back the pioneers of pop culture, you're going to run into very strange ideas. And this is something that I think was more widely acknowledged, say, 20 or 30 years ago than today. But as far as plans for the blog, I'm just sort of trying to just post as I go along. Just check it out, and I have topics organized in a tag menu. So if there's a particular topic that you're interested in, just click the tag, and or if there's a particular film or artist that you're interested in, just check the search menu. I am eventually going to move the site to a domain and organize things, more extensively, by topic and things like that. But it's a lot of work, and I just don't have the time for it. But I am gratified to say that, interestingly enough, January and February were the biggest months on the blog since 2012, strangely enough. So,
Wow, really? Do you think
yeah,
that's
I think that's very interesting. Like I said, there seems to be a very strange
2012 echo
Yeah,
coming up, yeah.
it's like a reverberation. That 2016, like I said, I remember reading a lot of fringe theories that 2016 is the real 2012, and things that were unleashed in 2012 are going to manifest in 2016. And so far this year, judging on the face of it, I'm having a lot of, difficulty arguing with that idea. Certainly, I mean, it's just the madness that seems to be afoot is just seems to be accelerating. And I just wonder, how, the it's almost like a pot boiling. At what point does the pot boil over? And that's certainly not a point that any of us want to see, but it starts to become a point that becomes inevitable, as people seem to be ratcheting up the pressure. People seen and unseen, as it were. So I will be following this as closely as possible. One of the stories that I give people a heads up that I do want to follow is this story of this kid, Kyle Odom. This kid who claimed that he was being menaced by Martian walk-ins. He shot a pastor up in Idaho who was associated with the Ted Cruz campaign. I don't know. Do you remember that story?
I did see it. I know I mean,
It's
my work schedule lately has been insane, so I haven't. But I did see it, and I saw
yeah.
there's I saw the illustration. Is that his illustration?
Yeah, it's yeah,
It,
it
there's
is.
something about that illustration that is so incredibly striking.
Yeah, it really does. It seems to resonate on a very strange level. I've been sort of collating information on that because I read his manifesto, and I've read a lot of manifestos from schizophrenics, believe me, over the years. And this thing, one of the disturbing things about his manifesto is how cogent it all seems. I mean, the things he's writing about are, certainly, off the wall and extreme, and there certainly seems to be a heavy psychosexual component to it all. But the way he expresses himself is disturbing to me. There's something about it that's getting under my skin. It certainly seems to me almost a classic textbook case of a paranoid schizophrenic breakdown. But at the same time, there's a level of lucidity there that I'm starting to wonder, there is the possibility of that he was being manipulated by outside agencies, and I'm starting to wonder if that's the case with this kid, that this breakdown was somehow induced, and that's sort of gotten under my skin lately, because he doesn't seem to exhibit some of the let's call it the asynchronous aspects of classic schizophrenia. He seems to be entirely too rational about explaining things that are completely
Right,
insane.
you're saying it's not the fractured thought that even some of us, some of us, I don't want to say suffer from or play with. Or those are two very loaded terms, but
Yeah,
I
well,
know
like I
what you
said,
meant. Yeah.
I've read a lot of these kind of manifestos, believe
Yeah.
me, over the years. I mean, I read a lot of these things on Usenet way back in the day, like on All Conspiracy, and I sort of recognize the patterns.
Absolutely, yeah.
Schizophrenia has a it almost has like a linguistic pattern to
I
it.
know
It
exactly what you're
has like
talking
it
about.
has a cadence,
Yes.
and I'm not recognizing it here, and that's kind of disturbing to me, and I want to find out why. I mean, it may just be atypical schizophrenia, and as of now, that would be my operating assumption. But there is the very disturbing fact that the person he described as being an alien, he shot the guy. There's some people claim that he was shot 6 times. Other people, he claims he shot him 12 times. And the news story says that the guy was fine. Like his friend that Kyle Odom had cited in his manifesto, had said, "Oh, he's perfectly fine. How are you shot 6 times, in the head and in the lungs and are perfectly fine?" So that was another, like, I don't know if that's just putting on a brave face for the media. I mean, that could certainly be what it is, but that there's just all these like weird oddities about this story that are kind of sticking in my head. And the other thing that's sort of sticking in my head about this is just how it ties into this whole narrative about reptilians and things like that, which I've never personally bought into. But it's interesting how, again, we just saw that in the X-Files, didn't we?
Absolutely.
Shape-shifting reptilians that live among us, So there's a very heavy X-Files tie-in with this kid, and plus there's also a human tragedy. I mean, this kid was extremely bright, extremely accomplished, was studying advanced genetics, And unfortunately, these are the kind of people a lot of times who do have schizophrenic breaks. Hopefully he'll get treatment and be able to recover at some point. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that this seems on the face of it to be just another story in modern day America of somebody who shouldn't have access to guns, getting access to guns and shooting innocent people. But there seems to be some dissonant notes in the melody. So I'm going to pay attention to this story. And that will probably show up in the blog. I don't know exactly what I'll find. Maybe I won't find anything, but it's gotten my attention, so.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And like I said, I'm gonna be honest. I said I really know very little about the story, but I just have seen the image, and there's something so haunting about that drawing, which doesn't. I mean, on the surface, doesn't make sense, because it's not like the drawing as you again. Almost, it doesn't have that frantic, sort of
It,
look to it. It's
it's
almost.
very, yeah, it's sedate and lucid.
Right, like this is what I saw. Let me try and illustrate this for you.
Well, that whole vibe carries through, his manifesto and his other writings, and the way they're organized. It's like he's putting together a PowerPoint presentation. For a corporate meeting. It's entirely too cogent. It's not unbroken walls of text, with no punctuation and random insertions of non sequitur. It's entirely too and it could be this is all an op too. I mean, that's another possibility.
We just spoke to Frank Zero, and talk about also all the different ways that someone could either induce this experience, not just like a quote unquote like a false flag, like a pretend operation, but that you could actually induce this experience in an innocent person.
Well, that's one of the threads that I'm going to be following, absolutely. Because he seems to have given some sort of indication that he was wondering if that indeed was happening. So, it's a very interesting story because it ties into so much of the themes that I've written over, I mean written about over the years. And it also ties into it's very Gnostic, and it ties into this overarching narrative of the rise and mainstreaming of Gnostic thought with conspiracy thinking as sort of a vector or carrier wave that Gnostic, almost classic Gnosticism is becoming much more widespread than ever before in history. And conspiracy thinking is acting as a vector. I mean, it's acting as a carrier for this new contagion. And I find that very, very fascinating because it runs counter to really the philosophic foundations of Western civilization,
I don't know
which
if
is
you
why
know.
It was constantly every time it did pop up,
Quiet.
it was quashed quite
Yeah.
violently.
Yeah.
It was eradicated. So, I mean, the fact that it's popping up now, and how technology is playing into that too, and how people's re relationship to technology and the rise of robotics and the rise of artificial intelligence are playing into this whole new Gnostic mindset.
Well,
I think
that's
this is
just
a
it. I think I said this to Frank last week. Was saying, it makes sense to me. Like, At some point, we have, Library of Alexandria. Well, now we have, and all these internet databases and whatever. We have what we thought of as like the Akashic Records. Well, we have this cloud. And I was like, we have this sort of literalizing of these metaphysical concepts. But now, as we become more immersed in this and this becomes our normal, it's not straight up virtual reality. We're not living in, any kind of Tron environment. But as we get more and more in seeped in this, it almost seems logical. It doesn't have to be schizophrenic. It doesn't have to be some madman. It becomes logical that you would begin to question your reality, and that this sort of Gnostic idea of is this world an illusion, and seeing the manipulation that's taking place, it almost seems like a very logical step that it would have. I was saying to Frank, like, it almost feels like it would have to be the logical belief system of the future.
Well, you
With
know,
that, with unless of course it was completely militantly eradicated, which it might be. I'm just saying, like, in a logical sense, that makes sense to me.
and the fact that everyone has access to media creating technology now, everyone knows how to create their own reality. Everyone experiences a great deal of reality through the screen and understands that that is manufactured, that they understand instinctually now that reality is constantly being edited, by who is controlling the camera, you know what I mean? By who is editing the imagery. Because they do that themselves. They do that themselves on their Snapchat. They do that themselves on their Instagram. They do that themselves on their Facebook. There's this instinctual understanding that comes from becoming not only the consumer of media, but also the producer of media, that they begin to question, the reality of everything they see. And the other thing that I think plays into this is the ubiquity of computer graphics. When they go to these films and see, say, like the Lord of the Rings, and are immersed, like say you go see the Lord of the Rings on a, I don't know, like a 150-foot wide screen, you become so completely immersed in this reality that it becomes more real than real. But then you walk outside and you understand that everything you saw was created on a computer screen, that can't help but filter into your understanding of the world itself. Is this That's why you hear so many people now talking. I mean, this has become like such an a pervasive thought contagion. Are we living in a hologram? Is this a
Precisely.
hologrammatic reality we live in? Because we are so used to experiencing hologrammatic reality in video games, on television, in film, blah, 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 blah. Virtual reality, I think, is only going to metastasize this process. So,
If you allow me, and I actually I do really got
yeah, me
running
too.
here,
Yeah,
but
definitely.
this is I can't resist. You said what you said there about everyone having access to editing capabilities, and how, like, we're seeing how movie magic works, right? That we can become the editors and blah blah blah. So I'm sure you've seen that. So my friend Joe Alexander, right? He made this video about Back to the Future predicts 9/11.
Yes.
It went like fucking insanely viral, right?
Yes.
I get so Joe, I don't want to say too much. Joe, that probably sounds like so. It probably sounds really wrong. I don't know how to say this. Joe is trying to be somewhat private of a person,
Yes.
and there's nothing nefarious there. If anyone did 2 seconds of Googling, they'd find out. Whatever. It's not a big secret, but he's just trying to be a private person, right? I get contact. So, like, I got contacted by like a fuckload of people trying to get in touch with this guy. When again, it blows my mind the level of journalism, quote unquote journalism, although all the people who wrote articles and contacted then didn't bother to Google the motherfucker's name. Anyway, we got contacted by The Hollywood Reporter, pretty like mainstream industry fucking magazine, right?
Yes.
Asking questions. And I forward Joe's response to them is almost exactly what you said. Now, nothing came of it, but it was interesting. Like when you were saying those words, basically they asked him, they were looking for a funny story or a something, and he
They were
gave them
looking to
that,
mock him.
right? And he gave them that philosophical answer of like, listen, we can all do this now, like. We understand how it works, and it was just, I mean, it was the most poetic. I wish they did print that. Imagine how that would change things, or just how that would shock people who think they're the elites of the movie industry. But there's another sort of positive note I want to add to this. When you talk about like say like you mentioned virtual reality and the like Lord of the Rings type stuff. So my wife and I, there's just enough age difference because of like say like advent of computers and whatever, as we're in the generation where just a few years difference means a very different sort of like technological concept. Like every now and then it just becomes apparent where I'm like, wow, really? And we watched that World on a Wire. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's a
No,
German movie. Holy
no.
shit, man, it's good. It's free on YouTube.
I do want to watch that. Absolutely, yeah.
Oh my God, like, is it free on YouTube? It's fucking incredible. But like, it's got like this, 70s aesthetic, but like this German surrealistic approach, but like with a very 70s aesthetic. And I was sort of afraid as I'm watching. Like, I think this is awesome, but like, I'm kind of like afraid. Is my wife gonna think this looks cheesy or dated and kind of not pay attention to it? And she was like so into it, and she was like terrified, and she's like, this is so creepy, and she was terrified. And I was like, oh, I was like, I'm glad the look of it, that sort of 70s almost hazy.
It's the film stock they use.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, it's like I'm whatever. So just to say, like, I think yes, we can be immersed in the cinematic like prowess of the modern cinematic like virtual reality that we can create any blah blah blah, but even still it still looks fucking fake to me, and somehow something that's quote unquote more unrealistic looking, if it's done right, can still truly pull you in a way that millions of dollars CGI can't.
Well, it's the magic behind it. It's the magic of the narrative is the difference. All the story, all the CGI is never gonna, compensate for that basic void at the center. And the basic void at the center is that lack of commitment, among the people telling the story, that they are just doing it to do it, because that's what they do. And there's such a difference between a story told by a committee and a story told by somebody with real passion. It's all the difference in the world. I mean, you can watch a story. I mean, never mind watch. I mean, a story told, by a cartoonist with a pencil and a piece of paper that can shred you to, to ribbons more than all the, $500 million worth of CGI ever will. So without that core, without that breath of life, there's nothing, and nothing can ever compensate for that.
Stop the sun from shining. there'll be more just like me who won't give in, will rise again, can't stop the world from turning. It's all over, but there'll be more just like me who won't give in, who'll rise again, can't stop a man from
thank you for listening to this broadcast from SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.